This is AM with Sabra Lane.
Catherine Brenner, the chairman of AMP, quits following an emergency board meeting. The second Gonski report is out today, recommending how to use the promised extra schools funding to improve results. I'll get the lowdown from the Education Minister, Simon Birmingham. And
it's bubbling nicely. It's not going too golden brown, too dark, too quick.
Can a new technique improve the flavour and appeal of mutton?
It's that complex, rich, buttery flavour. And those butter notes are ones that are incredibly craveable. And so it almost becomes almost like chocolate. And so think of it almost as the chocolate of meats.
Good morning and welcome to AM. The chairman of the wealth manager, AMP, Catherine Brenner, has just resigned. The decision comes after enormous pressure and a crisis meeting held by the board yesterday. It met after the Banking Royal Commission Senior Counsel warned on Friday that the company's executives might have engaged in criminal conduct. With more, I'm joined by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, who's covering the Royal Commission. And Peter, what has AMP said?
Well, Sabra, AMP has said that Catherine Brenner has resigned as chairman and will step down from the board. Mike Wilkins, who's also on the AMP board, has been appointed executive chairman effective immediately. Mr. Wilkins is going to be leading AMP as executive chairman for an interim period while they select a new chairman, and also they'll be on the hunt for a replacement for Craig Miller, who was forced to resign a couple of Fridays ago. And AMP has also announced that its Group General Counsel and Company Secretary Brian Salter is also leaving the company, and he was at the centre of the controversy over a supposedly independent report done for the corporate regulator ASIC, which had been tampered with by the AMP board as many as 25 times.
Now, this all comes as there are big proxy advisers that were pushing for board renewal. Will this appease those people who've been saying that they wanted more action from the board?
Well, Sabra, we've got the AMP Annual General Meeting coming up on May the 10th. It's expected there may well be a shareholder revolt there. There certainly would have been one if Catherine Brenner had not gone. But major shareholders have been unhappy. A couple have said that Catherine Brenner's position was untenable. Some proxy advisers saying that they would oppose the re-election of AMP directors Holly Kramer and Vanessa Wallace. But one of the big proxy advisers, ISS, is urging shareholders to follow AMP's voting guidance and return Ms. Kramer and Ms. Wallace. But Val Kolesnikov, the head of research for ISS, told me that he had little doubt that Ms. Brenner would survive.
The market needs to get confidence in the company. The market needs to have some faith in the management and the directors of the company.
Given what we've heard, do you think there is a need for new blood on the AMP board? Do you think that new directors or a clean out might be the answer?
It is very rare, and certainly, you know, the size company that AMP is, it's very rare for the entire board to go. What we do see is, you know, various directors that are responsible for certain actions and the governance of the company, there would be pressure on those directors to step aside. And to the extent that, you know, other directors have been involved and did not act as shareholders would expect, then over time I would believe that those directors would be going as well.
Now, Mike Wilkins is AMP's acting CEO, but he was on the AMP board at the time this possibly criminal behaviour occurred. Does that concern you?
Most definitely it is concerning. You know, somebody like Mike Wilkins, who's only been on the board for a year, it's important to understand exactly what all the directors, what they knew, should they have known, should they have acted faster and better. So, look, I believe the company's got to come out and be forthcoming in explaining what the directors' roles were.
That's Vaz Kolesnikov, the head of research at proxy advisor ISS. And Peter, what has the AMP advisory note also said today about remuneration of those who remain on the board?
Yes, well, one of the big features out of this announcement, buried right at the bottom, is that because of the impact on the reputation of AMP, the board will be reducing fees for all AMP board directors by 25% for the remainder of the 2018 calendar year. Brian Salter, who's leaving the company, his outstanding deferred pay will be forfeited as a result of the board exercising its discretion.
Okay, thank you. The ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. The federal government is unveiling the second Gonski report, which will recommend how to improve students' results, given the extra funding that's now being promised for schools. The government commissioned this review when it vowed to spend an extra $23 billion over the next decade on education. To discuss it further, I was joined a short time ago by the Federal Education Minister, Simon Birmingham. Good morning, Minister. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Sabra. Great to be with you.
One of the review's main recommendations is that there should be a major overhaul in approach to teach students according to their progression, not their year level. How complex will that be?
Well, this is a landmark report, and it does absolutely encourage schools to focus in on how you progress each and every student to their maximum capabilities so that we shift the entire level of student performance and have more high achievers as well as fewer underachievers. Now, teachers already do a lot of individualised targeted teaching in their classrooms, but importantly, these recommendations will put more tools and resources in the hands of teachers to make that more effective and simpler in terms of changing the national curriculum so that there are clear progression steps around what stages students are at that can be assessed and measured so teachers know then how to target the teaching to move them on to the next level, as well as putting a really integrated national tool in the hands of teachers that enables them to be able to identify clearly where their students are progressing, how well they're progressing, how that compares with the rest of the country, and then what steps they should take to move each student to the best of their capabilities over a 12-month period.
On that integrated national tool that you've just mentioned there, this is an assessment regime to test students in real time and compare their achievements at a regular interval. Will this information be made public?
No, this information is intended first and foremost for schools and teachers to know exactly how they're tracking and to be able to get detailed information. But of course, you would hope and expect that de-identified data and so on would be available to researchers, to policymakers, to create a cycle of continuous improvement there.
So will those results then be tied to teacher performance and pay?
We're not looking at performance pay in that sense, but the report does recommend that we look at how we keep our best teachers in the classroom. And we've already taken significant steps as a government in developing credentialisation for highly accomplished and lead teachers where they're recognised by their peers. What we'd like to see is more jurisdictions follow the lead of some others by better rewarding those highly accomplished and lead teachers to stay in the classroom and to be there as mentors for new teachers and lifting the standard quality and therefore regard with which the profession is held.
What you're setting out, the recommendations, will it all be compulsory for all schools if they don't sign up to this? Do they receive the extra Gonski funding?
This week we'll sit down with state and territory education ministers. David Gonski will come and brief them personally. We've already shared the report with them and he's certainly engaged with them in developing its recommendations. I hope that we'll see a strong level of enthusiasm to work together across boundaries, federal and state, Labor and Liberal, because ultimately this is about turning around significant problems in terms of performance in schools over recent years and getting us on a trajectory where our students are growing, are learning, are meeting clear literacy and numeracy standards in the early years, but are also leaving school with the competencies and capabilities to be successful in further study, training or into the workforce.
How soon will all of this start?
Different recommendations, of course, will be able to be applied at different speed, but the report clearly identifies we should be able to target things such as early years literacy and numeracy as a priority in terms of learning progression steps in the curriculum, development of the assessment tool, so that we can really get quick results.
How long then will it be until parents actually see improvements in what the students are achieving?
Well, I think it's important for parents to know this is not the only thing that's been happening. We've already taken steps to streamline parts of the curriculum, to invest in better training for new teachers coming into the profession. Of course, we addressed the issues of needs-based school funding in last year's budget. But I would hope that schools and parents will all start to see changes in terms of implementation of these practices over the next couple of years, and that really...
But improvements, when are we going to see?
And that really we should be able to see fairly quick improvements flowing from there.
Critics are already warning that this will condemn students to failure, that it's a dumbing down of Australia's curriculum. What's your response to that?
Well, far from it. This is about trying to ensure that every student is stretched and extended to their maximum capabilities. So the report identifies we have far too many cruising or coasting students and schools in Australia where kids go along aren't necessarily extended as much as they could be during the course of the year. So it's about how do we actually not just lift our tail of performance, but also get more high achievers, turn B-grade students into A-grade students by ensuring you're focusing very much in on what they know, what they learn, and stretching them to their maximum capabilities.
There's also going to be a rapid review of Year 11 and 12 to make sure that those students have got the skills to meet the demands that are required once they leave school. When will that be done, and isn't that really too late?
Look, that's something we'll talk to state and territory ministers about this week. I don't want to preempt their views on some of the recommendations. It's important this is done cooperatively and collaboratively. But, of course, we have a national curriculum that's in place right up to Year 10. We then have disparate state-by-state approaches in Year 11 and 12. So we'll get the feedback from the states and territories. But this should be looked at in the context, for example, of also the recent findings of the chief scientist, who was critical about university admission requirements, the way in which the ATAR works, the real drop-off in terms of students doing high-level maths at Year 12, all of which shows that there's some particular focus we've got to apply to reforms in those senior secondary years.
All right. Education Minister Simon Birmingham, thank you for joining AM this morning.
Thank you, Sabra.
A leading economist is forecasting at least a $7 billion boost to government revenues since the last update just before Christmas. Deloitte Access Economics has just published its pre-budget update. Its leading partner, economist Chris Richardson, is predicting the government will argue the huge jump in revenue will mean it can deliver small personal income tax cuts while not undermining a return to surplus. Yet, there are warnings this growth may not necessarily last and that the government should be careful about what it promises. Catherine Gregory reports.
The rivers of gold are running again. Forecaster Deloitte Access Economics predicts next week's federal budget will show a big jump in revenue and our bottom line.
What's happening at the moment is really rare, but suddenly the tax system's gone from £100 weakling to the Incredible Hulk. It's done it in a matter of months.
That's Deloitte's economist, Chris Richardson, who wrote the pre-budget report. It says overall revenues are due to grow by almost 10% this financial year and around 6% in the next one, and deficits have shrunk at the same time. Chris Richardson again.
I think the official figures will be more generous than ours. The way Treasury does these tends to bake in, you know, the latest switch. Good news, bad news tends to then hang around in their figures. Given those official projections, chances are you could see an $8 billion a year tax cut announced on budget night.
But the report does warn the government to guard these rivers of gold.
It's now absolutely raining revenue on the government, but that's just a period of catch-up which has occurred really fast and was meant to be continuing to occur in the next few years in the budget forecasts. It's mostly already happened with a bang.
Michael Croker is the Australian tax leader at Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand. He thinks we will see a better budget bottom line, but is wary about its longevity.
Well, the smart thing to do, I guess, would be to take advantage of the current benign interest rate environment and make sure that deficit gets under control. The government's long-term target has to be ensuring that the Australian economy can withstand shocks to the system. For example, future trade wars between the US and China. We hope that doesn't happen, of course. But there are things on the horizon which can always unsettle future projections. And also, you can't really take for granted this company revenue. It's something which is not as reliable, if you like, as personal income tax and GST.
He says his organisation's pre-budget submission highlighted the need for government to stick to the goal of returning to surplus by 2020-2021. As such, it suggested bringing in tax cuts gradually.
Well, personal tax cuts are desirable. We support them, but only in the context of a clear plan for deficit reduction and a undertaking that the personal tax cuts won't disappear in the next electoral cycle as bracket creep and other government expenditures come into play.
Catherine Gregory prepared that report. You're listening to AM and it's 14 minutes past 8. We can bring you some more details this morning about the federal government's efforts to keep secret some documents that go back 40 years. We told you on Friday that Australia's spy agency, ASIS, was trying to stop the release of information about intelligence operations during the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. Now we can reveal the government's also trying to keep under wraps details of Australia's ambitions for a piece of the lucrative energy resources in the Timor Sea. Peter Lloyd explains.
Diplomats, it's been said, are honest men sent abroad to lie for their country. But after digging in the National Archive in Canberra for records on Timor and Canberra's ambitions for oil and gas reserves in the Timor Sea, academic Kim McGrath reckons the public servants at home cause just as much strife.
I think they're still trying to keep the truth about the influence that the billions of dollars of oil and gas resources in the Timor Sea had on Australia's decision to encourage Indonesia's invasion of East Timor in 1975. And the latter decision to become the only Western nation to formally recognise Indonesia's sovereignty in East Timor in 1979.
After a stint as an advisor to the Timor government, Kim McGrath returned home to investigate her own, digging through the archives and unearthing skeletons.
My research has shown that we've deliberately written out the story of our interest in oil in terms of the history of our diplomacy with Timor and Indonesia. But I've pretty much...
To make it sound more noble.
To make it sound a lot more noble and less immoral in that period in the 70s when we were covering up and working sort of hand in glove with Indonesians to keep stories of the atrocities out of the media in Australia.
By 2012, requests for Timor papers were being turned down. Higher and higher officials in foreign affairs were signing off on the no. And it didn't make a difference if it was Labor or, after 2013, the Coalition.
The documents I'm seeking, they're not ASIO or ASIS files. They're just ordinary departmental correspondence and cabinet files.
Appeals at the archive are now exhausted. Kim McGrath today starts a 5-day hearing at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal to try to overturn this gag. But for most of it, she has to leave the room, while the government lawyers make a case involving what they say are still secrets in law. Kim McGrath reckons the process is Kafkaesque. James Norton from Gordon Legal in Melbourne is fighting for open government on her behalf.
Kim will and her legal team will probably be able to participate at least in open court in that process for one or two of those days, and the rest of the days will be reserved for the confidential the confidential session between the tribunal member and the representatives of the department.
And the Acting Attorney General, Greg Hunt, has slapped a ban order on the ABC and other media outlets, so we're barred from reporting what transpires. For Kim McGrath, it's a fight to unseat a DFAT-led myth of Australian benevolence to our needy new neighbour that turned out to have a natural line and length on the one thing Australians don't seem to find easy, diplomacy.
We need to own, the truth needs to come out.
Academic Kim McGrath, and that was Peter Lloyd reporting. As Australia struggles with the twin epidemics of obesity and diabetes, calls for a tax on sugary drinks grow ever louder. Last month, the UK became the 28th country to introduce a drinks tax, but public health officials have told tonight's Four Corners program a sugar drinks tax here is unlikely. Michael Brissenden reports.
Australia is now one of the fattest nations on earth. 60% of us are overweight or obese. By 2025, that figure is projected to rise to 80%. Stephanie Clark is one of Australia's obesity statistics.
You know, when you're by yourself and you're looking in that mirror and you go, gosh, I wish I could change that.
At her heaviest, Stephanie weighed 167 kilos and had a body mass index of 61. She blames her weight problem on poor food choices, too much fast food, large portion sizes, snacks and sugary drinks.
I'd drink at least a can of Coke a day, and that was just a regular part of my diet.
The path to obesity is a complex one, but public health officials have been campaigning for Australia to introduce a tax on sugary drinks. It wouldn't be the whole solution, but they say it would be a start. Michael Moore is the head of the Australian Public Health Association.
We know what it does. We know about the health impact, but there's something that's restricting us, and it's industry.
Michael Moore has sat across the table from industry representatives on many of the committees that have determined food policy and regulation. He says industry has had too much sway.
Look, the reality is that industry is, by and large, making most of the policy. Public health is bought in so that we can have the least worst solution.
Jane Martin from the Obesity Policy Coalition was a member of the committee that developed the Front of Pack Health Star rating system. She says food industry representatives fought successfully to scuttle efforts to make that system mandatory, and now the drinks industry is working against any suggestion of a sugary beverages tax.
It's not the public aren't on board, the politicians aren't on board. And the reason that a lot of the politicians aren't on board is because of this influence that we're seeing of groups like the Beverages Council, of these alliances in Canberra working against effective recommendations.
The Beverages Council admits it's spent a vast amount of resources lobbying against a sugar tax. But the council CEO, Jeff Parker, says singling out sugar as the cause of the problem is too simplistic.
This type of discriminatory and regressive tax continues to be a minority public health measure.
Retail politics is also a factor working against a sugar tax in Australia. Both the Coalition and Labor continue to oppose the idea. Sugar is a major employer in four marginal federal seats. Public health figures like Jane Martin say a tax is not the only answer to a complex problem. But what we're doing now is clearly not enough.
We need a strategy. We have no national obesity strategy. The leading public health issue currently in our society, and we do not have a strategy.
That's Jane Martin from the Obesity Policy Coalition. And you can see Michael Brissenden's report on Four Corners on ABC TV tonight at 8:30. The energy retailer Alinta has put in a formal offer to buy an ageing coal-fired power station in the New South Wales Hunter region. Liddell Power Station is currently owned by AGL and the company wants to shut it down in 2022. But Alinta says it wants to take over the site and keep it open. The federal government's been pressuring AGL to either sell the plant or keep it open to ensure the lights remain on. For more, I'm joined by political reporter Stephanie Boris. And Stephanie, what can you tell us about this Alinta bid?
Well, it was back in Easter that the federal government actually approached Alinta and said, would you like to consider buying Liddell Power Station? As you mentioned, the federal government is very keen to keep this station open. They're worried there won't be enough electricity in New South Wales if it closes down in 2022. So at the time, Alinta said they'd look into it. And now today, they have put in a formal bid. We've received a statement from the company. It says, we can confirm Alinta Energy has fulfilled our commitment and submitted a non-binding offer for the Liddell Power Station to AGL, which we believe represents a compelling commercial proposition for AGL shareholders.
So what exactly is the Alinta offering?
Well, in terms of a money figure, it is confidential at this point, but the ABC understands the offer is about $1 billion. That includes both the purchase price and investment. So the offer will obviously then be an unspecified portion of that billion.
Now, this plant has been at the heart of an energy ding-dong. Alinta isn't the only company, apparently, that's interested in looking at Liddell.
Yeah, well, AGL's never put a for sale sign out the front, effectively, of the Liddell Power Station. It's more keen to look at new investment and different ways of creating energy for the market. But it has always said it will consider any credible bid. And these bids are coming in because the federal government's looking around to see who else could take it over. Delta Electricity is the other company that has feigned interest in it, but they haven't put in a formal bid. So this is the first formal bid that AGL has received on the Liddell Power Station.
And any word from AGL?
No, I've put in calls. I've asked for comment. We're still waiting to hear back from them. Obviously, this bid is very new, so I think they're still trying to work out how to respond.
All right. Stephanie Boris, thanks for joining us this morning. Drug experts today will pore over data collected during the weekend at the first Australian pill testing trial at a music festival. Fans queued to have illicit drugs tested and bins were supplied at the Groove and the Moo event in Canberra to allow the dumping of unsafe drugs. Tom Eagledon reports.
Rockers Grinspoon power their way through their classic song, Dead Cat. It sounds like any other festival, and there's the usual druggy vibe. Even the band's named after early pro-cannabis advocate Lester Grinspoon. The But there's something different about Groovin' the Moo this year.
This is a great moment to see the first trial of pill testing here in Australia. It's been operating overseas for many years.
That's ACT Health Minister Shane Rattenbury. He's been instrumental in getting the trial happening.
Accepting the reality that young people are going to experiment, they are going to take drugs. We've seen the ambulance service, the police, the University of Canberra, ACT Health and the government all say this is the best policy-based approach.
Young festival goers also approve.
There's that many people that overdose these days, especially from festivals like this.
If you didn't have it, people would still bring stuff in, so you might as well have something.
But others hope the trial won't spread to other festivals.
I don't think that is something that you should be doing, you know, authorised through sort of some type of government involvement at a rock concert.
Federal government backbencher Craig Kelly says it's encouraging illegal drug abuse.
Going down the track that, yes, we can have this pill testing and these drugs are okay, I think sends the absolute opposite message to what we should be working on.
Craig Kelly considers himself pro-harm reduction, having been on a parliamentary inquiry looking into the issue. He approves of Portugal's approach, decriminalising recreational use of small quantities of even the hardest drugs. Users are still arrested, but then put in an education program.
It has been a success. It has significantly reduced their drug death rate. And also, most importantly, has reduced the uptake or usage of drugs.
He says pill testing will have the opposite effect.
I think it gives the message that some drugs are good and some drugs are bad. That I think the message we need to be getting out to young people is no matter what you take, all these pills are bad for you.
But Shane Rattenbury says the health workers who conduct the pill tests do use the opportunity to educate potential drug users.
And I imagine there'll be results come out that show how effective it can be in intervening in the risk-taking behaviour of some young people.
As researchers pour through the data from the weekend trial, one number in particular will be keenly watched.
How many people discard their pills after the conversation is one of the key measures of success that we've seen overseas. It's been in the sort of 60 and 70% range when people have had contaminants pointed out to them, also the personal risks. And I think that could well be a trend we see repeated here.
That's the ACT's Health Minister Shane Rattenbury ending Tom Iggledon's report. Mention mutton and most Australian foodies would probably turn their noses up, but maybe not for much longer. Farmers think they're on the cusp of a new culinary trend that could double the price of mutton for farmers and boost the menu range of top restaurants. Mutton's tough texture and gamey taste has always been far less popular in Australia than lamb, which is why most of it gets exported. But researchers are finding that dry aging it could change that. And chefs in search of uniquely Australian cuisine are hungry to give it a go. Marty McCarthy reports.
It's bubbling nicely. It's not going too golden brown, too dark, too quick.
This is when the saying, mutton dressed as lamb, gets literal.
We're making the mutton piccata. So we've used the silver side and we've sliced it thinly, about 2 or 3 mil, lightly crumbed it, a little bit of parmesan, some parsley and some lemon, and then we're just shallow frying it.
Dale Lyman is a chef at Melbourne Cooking School, the William Anglis Institute. And he's trying to dress up dry-aged mutton.
Okay, so we need to make sure this is nice and hot.
It's a process used already for beef, but a handful of producers in Australia are using the technique to improve the taste of mutton, which has long fallen out of favour with Australian palates.
When we first saw the mutton, we didn't quite know what to do with, but after a lot of trial, we've come up with some really good dishes and we've really learnt a lot about the animal and how the best way to cook it.
He's also serving it in sliders and Vietnamese soup.
It's just a fantastic opportunity to keep trying all these different things.
A group of food experts from the University of Melbourne are looking at whether there's demand for it in Australia. The university's enterprise director, Hollis Ashman, is one of them.
It's that complex, rich, buttery flavour, and those butter notes are ones that are incredibly craveable. And so it almost becomes almost like chocolate. And so think of it almost as the chocolate of meats.
Dry aging involves the drying and dehydration of meat in a controlled environment for a number of weeks or months to draw out more flavours.
Crust grows on the outside of the meat, and the inside of the meat becomes very tender, very juicy, and the flavours and all the enzymes concentrate, and it tastes really good.
In recent years, a handful of farmers in Western Australia have been pioneering the industry. Robin Jacobs from WA's Department of Primary Industry says making it commercial will be good for foodies and farmers alike.
Well, traditionally, wet-aged mutton goes for quite a low price, so it's a low-value product that's often about half the price of lamb. So the idea of this product is that we try to get the value up to a similar value to what lamb is. So, you know, potentially we could double the value of meat that comes from older animals.
Robin Jacobs from the West Australian Department of Primary Industry and Regional Development, Marty McCarthy with that report. To finance now, the Reserve Bank Board meets tomorrow, yet the cash rate is expected to stay on hold at the historic low of 1.5%. Also this week, we'll see the latest profit reports from the ANZ and National Australia Banks. The Australian dollar is weaker this morning, trading at 75.7 US cents. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.